And tonight on Coast to Coast AM, we bring you the greatest storyteller ever born, Lionel Fanthorpe, and we're going live to Lionel in the United Kingdom in just seconds on Coast to Coast AM. I think he might have been around not because of his age, but during the days of Merlin the Magician and all these mystical people. Lionel Fanthorpe, currently Director of Media Studies at Cardiff Academy, and he is a fully ordained Anglican priest, working part-time, unpaid, for the church in Wales. He's also the president for the Association of Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena, and also the British UFO Research Association. You do so many things, Lionel. How are you, my friend?
I'm absolutely fine, George. It's great to talk to you and to all our friends out there. You know, I just want to say an enormous thank you. My email has been flooded with regular listeners who've heard us in the past and who say, have a great show, we'll be listening, and you know, all the usual. And I just want to thank them for all that encouragement. It's terrific.
Well, you know, every once in a while, I need my Lionel Fanthorpe fix. You know, I go a few months, we haven't talked, and I call Tom up and I say, Tom, it's time, or Lisa, let's do it. And here you are. It's good to hear your voice again.
Yeah, and one of the things I was just mildly anxious about this morning, and I heard your comment about the weather being so crazy.
Oh, it's bizarre.
The last thing we had on our weather forecast here in the UK on the radio was that there's this enormous solar storm heading this way pretty well any minute now. And they said it was going to disrupt satellite communication, phone lines. Are you having any trouble with it in the States?
Not yet. It's nighttime here. They're talking about it in the morning. An X5, and it could disrupt GPS systems, communications. It could take down the power grid. Our grid in the United States, Lionel, is not insulated. It is not foolproof on one of these flares. Now, an X5 is big. We've had bigger. Yeah. 5 years ago, there was an X45 that took out the power around Canada and every place else. But this is still pretty big.
So, as we're still nighttime in the States, we're going to be okay.
Yeah, we will.
So, if it hits Wales and the UK and I suddenly disappear off air, you'll know it's not my fault, it's the solar storm.
Well, I want to tell everybody, too, to you know, if you have dropped phone calls in the morning, this is probably why, with your cell phones going out.
Yeah. So one of the things that interests me about that very much is, you know, recently there have been some pieces of research work done at a number of universities in which, when certain, should we say, external influences, radiation, or when there's somebody near an electric pylon that's giving out some kind of energy fields or electromagnetic fields.
You can hear that buzz. Zzz.
Yeah, and that they seem to have, it seems to contribute to the witness's ability to experience psychic phenomena. And in some of the experiments, it seems to have led to an increase in what appears to be telepathic ability. So I was wondering, you know, with the vast coverage that you've got on Coast to Coast, if when this storm hits the USA tomorrow, when the light comes up, see whether they're going to be, if it's possible to sort of just ask around and see whether there are any increases in reports of psychic phenomena because the solar storm has done something to stimulate that part of the brain which is able to receive them. You know, just a thought.
Sure. And what about strange animal behavior and things like that? And anything's possible.
Yes, it is. And, of course, when we think about the five basic theories that go with psychic phenomena in general, one of them is this idea that there is some sort of electromagnetic influence or some sort of radiation influence which affects the ability to see and hear these things.
We're going to go through a number of stories tonight with Lionel Fanthrop. What's new with you career-wise? What's happening?
Well, currently, I'm working on a new book on numerology, and that's fascinated me doing the research on that. And again, career-wise, I'm doing some regular presentations for BBC.
Good for you.
There's a show there called The Seventh Dimension, and I'm one of a team of presenters who bring those on. And you can guess, with a title like Seventh Dimension, the kind of material we're going to have there, the kinds of things that you and I enjoy talking about.
Oh, I still think back of the moment when you came into the States to do that show with me for the Sci-Fi Channel. And that was fun. I enjoyed that. You remember that?
I enjoyed that enormously. Hey, I got to tell you about a show. I was with a film crew. This would just be Thursday of last week, so just a week ago. And we were making some fairly melodramatic fiction, and about when we're putting in some real-life paranormal as well. And my producer-director friend on that show called me and said, "Lionel, how do you feel about doing some filming late at night? We need an empty woodland for this particular scene, which we'll then edit in." Oh, and he said, "I've also got a pair of red contact lenses because we want you to be the bad guy."
That's funny.
So I haven't worn contact lenses for years, but I used to use them regularly. And I thought, oh, yeah, I can handle this. So my producer, director, pal, and the film crew duly turn up, and we got the red contact lenses, and I managed to get them in, and then we disappeared into this lonely wood, which is near one of the big parks here in Cardiff. And if you can imagine this, there's a car parked by the side, and in the wood, there's the film crew with the lights, and there's this weird-looking guy with bright red eyes, and the car took off at speed.
I would, too. What's it like,
thought,
by the way, with red?
Any minute now, we're going to have the police around here looking for a crazy man with red eyes.
With red contacts, what's it like?
Yeah.
Is everything red?
Yeah, no, it's got a tiny little a hole in the middle. It just covers the iris, and the hole in the middle lets you see through.
Ah, okay.
But it was... I thought at first it was going to make everything look red, but it just... When they used the lights at the right angle, it came off there like a red firework in each eye. It was amazing.
I love it. How many?
I'm looking forward to seeing the cuts when they put it back.
How many books have you and Patricia written so far, Lionel?
Well, in of recent years, we've done the one on the numerology that we're just finishing. That will be number 19 in the series of Unsolved Mysteries. You know, it was the world's most mysterious people, the world's most mysterious places.
Right.
They've just brought out a revised edition of one of the first that I ever did for them, that Patricia and I did for them 20 years ago, on the Oak Island mystery. So that's going to be... And when you were asking how many books, George, it's my 60th anniversary as an author in print.
Good for you.
I sold the first 60. One in 1952. And if I count all of those, because I then used to work flat out for a big paperback publisher called Badger Books, and for them, I did the best part of 200. So if I then add those to... Oh, and then, of course, there's 20 or 30 of my religious books on the top. So we've got a couple of hundred there, 20, 30 religious. It won't be far short of 300 with the two new ones that are coming out this year.
That's pretty prolific, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it took me long enough. It's a 60-year haul, and I'm looking forward to the next 60 years. I have no intention of giving up. I'll tell you a story I heard the other day, which I found absolutely inspirational. The outline was that this guy is now a professional stage conjurer and a very good one, and he is 93, repeat, 93 years old and still pulling in the audience. And the story behind him is quite incredible.
I hope I can do that.
Yeah, you and me both. We've got to keep this going, Jude.
That's right.
And anyhow, what happened was that he was in the Second World War, and he was with forces who were against Japanese in the Far East. And in the course of the fighting, he almost lost a hand, and it was pretty well hanging. And he was taken prisoner, and the surgeon was about to amputate the remains of this right hand. And somebody near the surgeon in the medical team had seen this bloke performing his conjuring tricks before he'd been called into the army. And he said, if you can save the hand, sir, save it. And all they could do for him was to manage to keep the blood supply going, but it was immobilized. And it was sort of fastened into a thing like a sling to his chest. And it was there for the duration of the war in this immobile position, just slung there. After the war, he came home and he'd been practicing conjuring with his left hand, and he was still able to perform. He was walking down the street in English town and tap on the shoulder. The voice said, do you recognize me? It was the surgeon who had left the hand intact. And he said, I am now at a big private hospital here, and I'm specializing in this kind of work. If you'd like to come in, I can get that hand mobile again for you. And he said, I can't afford a private hospital. And the surgeon said, it's on me, son, it's on me. Come in tomorrow. And after months of repeated operations, the hand came back into use. And the guy is now 93 years old, and he's still conjuring, and he's using that hand.
Isn't that a miracle?
I thought that was, that's the word. Absolutely miraculous. I'd love to go and see one of his shows. I'm going to look him up on the net and find him.
Well, let me tell you, we played 'Twas the Night Before Christmas for you on Christmas Eve. And,
right.
Before that. And everyone loves it.
I'm just so grateful. I'm so pleased to be associated with Coast to Coast. It's wonderful.
Let's talk a little bit about some of these mysteries out of your books. And let me ask you about Oak Island.
Yes, of course.
Now, where was Oak Island? Where is it? What's the story?
Right. Well, Oak Island is in Mahone Bay. And that in itself is a romantic name because of Mahone, which is spelled M-A-H-O-N-E, was a kind of ship which was greatly favored by pirates in the 17th and 18th centuries. The island itself in Mahone Bay is just off the coast, the Atlantic coast of Nova Scotia, not far from the little fishing village of Chester and a few miles south of Halifax. And the story began, or should we say the modern part of the story began in 1795. Three teenage boys, Smith, Vaughan, and McGinnis, had taken a day off and were going out to explore the uninhabited islands. And there were over 300 of them. Mahone Bay is a wonderful place to explore.
Scattered everywhere, aren't they?
Scattered everywhere throughout the bay. And they landed on this one, which was called Oak Island, because it was then covered with the old red oaks that were popular at the time. And they started to explore, and they came across a small clearing. There was a big, very sturdy oak tree there with one branch growing over the clearing. The end of the branch had been lopped off, and from it there hung an old ship's block and tackle. The boys immediately thought, somebody has buried something heavy. And they started thinking in terms of pirate treasure and, you know, traditional treasure chests. They could see in the center of the clearing that somebody had excavated some earth and it had settled again. So home they went. They came back with picks and shovels. And they were so optimistic about finding the pirate treasure. Well, they got down a few feet and they hit were brick hard clay. These oak logs had been let into it. The lads could still see the pick marks and the shovel marks where the original diggers had hit these hard clay walls. The stuff the boys were taking out was very loose, easy, friable backfill. They managed to get the oak logs out, thinking that the treasure would be underneath. But it wasn't. There was just more of the backfill. They went down as far as they could, and they hit another platform of oak logs, and they realized that this was far more than three guys could handle by themselves. And the word spread. They told, you know, parents and families and friends. And a while later, an expedition, fully equipped, came across. They'd brought horses. This is now the very early 19th century, about 1802, 1803. And this early expedition came across. And they got down to a depth of over 100 feet. Every 10 feet, more or less, there was a platform of oak logs. And they also took out the kind of caulking clay which was used on the old ships to waterproof the hull.
They must have been baffled with all that.
Yeah, it was amazing. And there was also layers of coconut fiber and layers of charcoal. They were down at the 100-foot level, approximately, when the guys who were down there doing the excavating shouted up the shaft, "It's getting wet down here."
Of course. I don't know what took it so long.
And the guy at the top, a bit anxious about his colleagues, ever said, "You boys better come up. And we'll come back again first light in the morning and see what it's like." Well, at first light, there was nearly 100 feet of water.
Yep, it filled right back up, didn't it?
Yeah, it filled up. And over the next 200 years, one expedition after another has been over there and has tried to beat that flood water. But the guys who sank the shaft in the beginning must have been outstandingly good engineers. They created an artificial beach, and it was below this artificial beach with its big boulders that they put their two flood tunnels so that they wouldn't silt up. And I think that it was to do with the caulking clay, which produced a watertight, airtight seal. And once they'd gone down through that, the whole idea of the flood trap was based on that. And if that clay was broken, then it would release the air pressure so that the water could come in and trap anybody. That anyone who knew the secret, anyone who was part of the organization that had built the money pit, well, they would know straight away that you seal off the flood tunnels, and they'd have had the secret of where the seals were.
How much money do you think was down there, Lionel?
Well,
is it still there?
Yeah, nobody's ever got anything. Well, an odd jewel and a few links of gold chain have come up. But the clue to what was down there, there was a very strange piece of porphyry stone found, and it was engraved. And Professor Barry Fell, who was an expert on these things, and our dear old pal George Young, who used to live nearby and was a surveyor and was a Canadian naval officer, so he knew a lot about the sea and he knew a lot about the land.
Hold on right there, Lionel. We're going to come back in just a moment, talk a little bit more about Oak Island. It's a mystery, and also we'll talk about reincarnation. We've got to get the Spring-Heeled Jack story in again, and much more with Lionel Fanthorpe, the greatest storyteller ever born. Lionel, let's talk a little bit about vampires for a moment.
Yeah, sure.
In your research, in your books, did you come across any vampire stories?
Well, the most intriguing vampire story that I've come across anywhere in the world is the one that comes at Croglin Grange near Penrith, here in what we call the Lake District in the UK. And what I like so much about this is that it's one of those now-you-see-it-now-you-don't vampire mysteries. And when we investigated it on site, first you thought, hey, this is exactly what it says in the accounts, and then things start to contradict each other, and you think, oh, it's all been made up, and then it all comes together again. It's an amazing tale. What happened was that a family named Cranswell took a seven-year lease on Croglin Grange, which is also known as Croglin Low Hall. And after they'd been there, it was a single-story building, so all the bedrooms had to be at ground level. There was no upstairs. There was a girl and her two brothers in the family, just the three of them. Her name was Amelia, and she was looking out through her bedroom window across the beautiful big lawn that was part of the estate, and she saw something coming towards the house.
Oh.
Very late at night. She described it as a walking scarecrow with red eyes, and she was terrified. She moved, it got to her bedroom window and started to unpick the old diamond lead panes. It got its hand or claw through and opened the casement. Well, by this time, Amelia had backed up to the bedroom door, which was locked, trying to unlock it so her brothers could come in and help her, or she could get out. She dropped the key. And you know how difficult it is if you're trying to do something with your hands behind your back. Left seems to be right, and right seems to be left, and up is down, and she'd made an awful muddle of it. So here she is, locked in the bedroom with the key on the floor, and the thing is now climbing in through the window. She was screaming blue murder for her brothers to come and help, and of course they couldn't get through the locked door. And these sturdy old Lake District houses had very thick doors, almost like the door of a church or the door of a castle. They were really built to last. And by the time the boys had broken it down and got in to rescue Amelia, she'd been bitten all around the face and throat, and lost a lot of blood. And this was where, because of the bites to her throat, the idea that she'd been attacked by a vampire made its way into the story. Well, she was hanging between life and death because the bites had been so severe, but she recovered. She was a tough kid. And the boys said, we're going to take you to Switzerland, and we're going to have a few weeks there for you to recuperate. While they were in Switzerland, this girl, Amelia, as I said, had got the courage of a lion, and she said, we are not going to be driven out of our seven-year lease just because of this, but I want you boys to buy two pistols, and then I've got a plan for when we get home again. There was Mike, who was the bigger of the two, and Ed, who was slim and athletic. And she said, Ed, I want you to have the bedroom nearest to the front door. And then she said, if that thing comes back, I want you, with one of the guns, out of that front door and shoot him. Then she said, Mike, if I scream, I want you straight to me. He was a big, tough character. And he said, of course I will, with the other gun. So she's got two fully armed brothers who both think the world of her and would risk anything to keep her safe. And she's got this wonderful plan. She'd have made a good general, that girl. And all the bedroom doors left open. And within a matter of weeks of their return, the thing sets out across her lawn again, coming towards her, and her plan works perfectly. She screams. Mike is beside her in about 3 seconds, flat with a gun. The thing had reached the window. It looked in, and it saw a very big, angry man with a gun in one hand, and it fled, but not quick enough, because Ed had come around the corner from the front door, and with a matter of a few feet, shot it in one leg. He deliberately aimed for the legs to bring it down. It uttered a piercing scream and limped towards a church with the tombs around it. Ed is in hot pursuit, and the thing, whatever it was, disappeared into one of the tombs and shut the door behind it.
Oh, and never to be seen again.
Well, Ed is now, it goes on. Ed is now in a quandary. He's not Big Mike, who would have gone straight in after it and hammered it. He's got an empty pistol, and he's not that big. He's a good athlete, but he's not a big fella. And he knows what it did to Amelia last time, and he doesn't want to get bitten, so he's not going in on his own. He goes for help. When he comes back with a party of the villagers, who look a little bit, I would imagine, like Rent-A-Crowd, you know, the blacksmith with a hammer and a couple of guys with pitchforks, as they do in all the best horror films when they go up to the monster's castle. So there is the crowd of villagers and the two Crownswell boys, plus half a dozen of their sturdy friends, go into the tomb. And they're confronted by a dais on which is an open coffin. A partly decayed body lies in that coffin, and there's fresh red blood on the mouth and on both hands. They are now convinced they've got a vampire. So they take it to the crossroads, and they go through all the vampire folklore they've ever heard of, and they sever the limbs, take off the head, and pierce it.
With a stake.
With a stake, and then they burn the bits. They think, if ever we got rid of a vampire, this one's been done. While they are dismembering it, someone in that party finds a pistol ball in one of the legs. Now they're convinced this was it. This was the one that Ed shot at.
Sure.
So, apparently, you know, the whole thing is a vampire of some sort, and there were no more attacks in the village, which made them even more convinced that they really had got it. Now, Patricia and I went up to Croglin Low Hall and set out to find the places where there was a bricked-up window, which is the one the vampire was supposed to have gone through. And then we looked and saw, something's wrong. It was two stories, and it should only have been one. Then we looked around. We couldn't find a church anywhere. We went to the village 2 miles away and found a rather modern, rebuilt Victorian 19th century copy of a Gothic church, and there were no vaults there into which anything could have hidden. Thought, that's gone wrong. And then we started thinking, why did these boys take single shot pistols? I would have wanted a Colt 44 Magnum if I'd been going after that thing. So things seemed to be completely wrong. The building was wrong. The church was so far away, there was no way the thing could have got to a vault. And the guns, on reflection, were wrong. Well, now, the story had been mistaken, badly mistaken. We spoke to the farmer who then owned Croglin Hall. Lovely lady, Mrs. Johnson, ever so helpful. And she said, you see those marks on the wall? And we looked up, and she said, an architect friend of mine told me that there was once a single-story building here, and they put in a second story years later. So it had once been single-story. Then she pointed to a patch of earth only 50 yards away from her building and said, I can't plow that piece of ground. I have to leave it for pasture. I can't plow it because there's the remains of an ancient church there, and my plow keeps hitting foundation stones. So that solved problem number two. The church was once there. And then we realized what was wrong with the story as it had been told, because it had apparently taken place in Victorian times, but it hadn't. The story went, when we we made further inquiries, the story went all the way back to the 17th century when men did use single-shot pistols, and Oliver Cromwell's men had come in and damaged that church, and the villagers of the time in the 1600s had taken away the stone for their own building purposes. So everything came back, and there really had been an adventure of that sort. I was telling this story as one of my lectures, and in the audience, when we came to question time, there was a young doctor, and he said, "Lionel, I think I've got an idea. May I?" I said, "Yes, please do, doctor. Come on up. Come on, talk to us." And he said, "What if it wasn't a vampire in the supernatural sense, but someone who was mentally ill and maybe thought he was a vampire?"
Which is possible. That's possible.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And then the doctor suggested that because of his mental illness, extreme melancholia, he had made himself a den in one of the tombs, rather like the guy in the New Testament, you know, the man who lived among the tombs.
Mm-hmm.
And then, he said, he attacked various other people, and then he'd attacked Amelia. And when he came back to have another go, young Ed shot him and then pursued him back to the tomb. And he thought, "They want a vampire? I'll give them a vampire." He managed to work the pistol ball out of his leg and thrust it into the leg of the long-dead corpse that was in that tomb. On that, he takes some more of his fresh red blood and smears the mouth and the hands of the corpse. He peeps out of the door, and Ed has gone to get help, so he escapes. Now, this is where the doctor came in with his medical knowledge. He said a few weeks later, he would have been found dead in a ditch somewhere because of gangrene.
Mm-hmm.
He'd handled a corpse and then handled an open wound on his leg, a bad wound, and had infected himself with fatal gangrene. Now, I thought that was one of the most amazing kind of patterns of stories and explanations and theories all wound round together, and how first of all it appeared to be complete nonsense because the building was wrong and the church was wrong, and then on further investigation everything came right again and was rational and logical. And I even liked the doctor's suggestion that it wasn't a vampire, but it was simply someone mentally ill who thought he was.
They just won't accept the possibility that they could be real, do they?
No, they don't. But it's, I think, you know, the stuff that Montague Somers wrote about the vampire in Europe, there have been some inexplicable accounts of things that don't seem entirely human. And then there was all that very strange business in Highgate Cemetery here in London, where a lot of hunting was done for what was described as a vampire. So it has to have a question mark over it. I wouldn't write them off. I think we live in such a mysterious universe that anything, literally anything, is possible.
Lionel, in the United Kingdom, are they still fascinated with the scary television shows, scary movies?
Oh, yes. Yes, they're as popular as ever, and especially on television. We have all kinds of paranormal television channels, and I get invited now and again to come and do a guest appearance on one of them, which I love doing. And, yeah, we got all sorts of things. One of the most amazing mysteries of recent years and still on the go was the famous haunted car story.
Haunted car?
Yeah, it was a Ford Capri, and it had the number plate ARC 666.
That's one of the reasons.
That was one of the reasons it was believed to be haunted. And I was called over with a television team to perform an exorcism on it, because the tales that had been told about it, brakes had overheated, wheels come off, all sorts of odd things that shouldn't have happened. And the car had changed hands several times. Now, the car, and I've driven it, it didn't do anything to me. The car was situated near Eastbourne, which is on the coast, and Eastbourne, or very near Eastbourne, was the place where the black magician Aleister Crowley spent his last few years of life, and he died there. And he always claimed, of course, that he was the great beast from the Book of Revelation, and his number was 666, like the car number plate. And the general sort of thoughts about it were that if it was haunted, it was the rather negative ghost of Aleister Crowley that was haunting the car, which he thought of as his because it had his 666 on it. So I went down there one day by train to do another exorcism on it for another film company. And as I was coming home by train, I got to the station in London, Paddington, which is the one that connects with Cardiff, and it's a sort of two-hour journey. And I phoned Patricia and said, I'm on the 10 o'clock, and I used a phrase I think we ought to try to avoid: nothing can go wrong, because some of those trains go right through Cardiff and onto the coast, and you can then get taken across on a boat train to Ireland. And if you go to sleep, instead of getting out at home, you may find yourself in the, you know, among the beauties of Dublin
yeah,
in the morning.
Exactly. And so, not even know you got there, how you got there.
And you wouldn't know how you got there. So this particular train stopped at Cardiff. That it didn't go on further. So I thought, well, if I go to sleep, it won't matter. One of the railway team will say, would you wake up now, sir? We've got to the end of the journey.
That's right.
So I said about nothing can go wrong. And the blessed train got as far as Reading, which was only a few miles out of London. And suddenly there's a jerk and a judder and a bang and a thump, and it rocks. And a voice comes over from the train manager's loudspeakers: we're so sorry, ladies and gentlemen, we've got to stop here. Vandals have thrown logs across the line. And I couldn't help thinking, if I just threw Aleister Crowley out of his car, he's just thrown me out of
my
train.
That's right. He came back to get even. Lionel, we're going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back for a final hour with you of these incredible stories. Lionel's website, Lionel-Fanthorpe.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com.